Welcome, members and guests, to the October 4th meeting of the City Club of Eugene. Welcome, KLC listeners and to our TV audiences on community television and the Oregon Wind Network. I'm Marty Wilde, the City Club president. Our sponsors today are Network Charter School, a standards-based, hands-on public school for students in grades 7 to 12. Duncan and Brown, real estate analysts. Dotson, imagery experts for over 80 years. And a special thank you, as always, to KLCC for airing these programs on Monday night, and KPFF consulting engineers for our office space. We're having a special event. The City Club Follies is shaping up to be a lot of fun. We have at least 10 acts lined up covering topics from gun control to biking in the summertime in the Emerald City. If you still want to be included in the cast, it is not too late. We are grateful for the generous hospitality of Cosmic, which is offering the site and technical assistance to us as its in-kind contribution. We have collected raffle prizes from the Oregon Country Fair, Network Charter School's culinary program, the Pantry Cafe, and Sacred Earth Botanicals. Don't forget, the Follies show happens on Sunday, October 20th, from 5 to 8 p.m. at Cosmic at 8th and Charlton. The suggested donation is only $5, and you can buy more votes if you give us more money for your favorite. The economy and employment course City Club is currently offering with Lane Workforce Partnership has launched successfully. Educators from Eugene 4J, South Lane, Bethel, Crow Applegate Lorraine, West Lane Tech, and Network Charter School had a grand tour of Seneca Sawmills this week. We are a member-supported organization. If you are not already a member, please consider a tax-deductible virtual or regular City Club membership, sponsorship, or donation. Today's topic is digital privacy and the National Security Administration. Who is reading your email and what you can do about it? And here's our organizer, Randy Prince, to introduce our speakers.
Hi. Today's City Club topic is privacy, an expectation we have as Americans, and it's a right spelled out in law. Well, this year we've been confronted with a challenge to privacy from electronic surveillance conducted by government agencies, said to be authorized by law or Congress, and protected from full oversight by the stated need to keep intelligence methods secret from the nation's adversaries. Nonetheless, we have learned a lot about these methods, and we're still learning, because lawmakers like our own Senator Wyden, well, he could only warn us that there were suspicious activities taking place, but he did call it to our attention. And incidentally, we are hoping to hear from Senator Wyden here at the City Club, schedule permitting. He approached us with his desire to bring this national conversation to us here in Eugene. Well, it was a person from within the intelligence community that emerged to provide details on some of these questionable activities by the National Security Agency, the NSA, and more than a dozen agencies that spend an acknowledged black budget of over $52 billion a year. And so much of this year, the news has been dominated by these Snowden revelations, inside information delivered by a young worker in that industry, Edward Snowden, delivered to Glenn Greenwald, a reporter for the British newspaper, The Guardian. Well, I don't know about you, but I have trouble keeping track of all these sinister-sounding programs that have been uncovered, much less how they work. The spy methods of the past were relatively simple. You pick some locks, tap some phones, steal some papers out of a file cabinet. Getting to that point maybe was a bit more difficult, you know, like the case of a certain political candidate named Richard Nixon. He was running for re-election in 1972, and when he wanted to snoop on his opponents, he had to assemble a team of rogues to burglarize offices at the Watergate and elsewhere. But now it's reported that an NSA can simply just type in a request to get some pretty private info on someone they're thinking about dating. However, the data they're tapping into is much more complicated than a file cabinet or an analog phone line. And so to explain that and some of the rights we have to be protected from that abuse, we have two speakers. Our first speaker is Seth Woolley. He works for Dicarda, a Silicon Valley spatial database outfit, and he has been employed in a variety of capacities in that industry and working including on security vulnerabilities in some of the important web technologies. Seth is also an activist, and he's run for Secretary of State, and he was praised for his brain power. Advisory board of the Pirate Party of Oregon and nationally, that's an outfit that works for protecting the privacy rights on a global basis. Our second speaker is Kyu Ho Yum. His specialty is about these laws and our rights. He is the inaugural First Amendment Jonathan Marshall Chair at the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication. Also, he serves as guest professor in the University of Oregon Law School. His focus is on the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, intellectual property, and additional areas. His articles are cited by in many important court cases. He serves on the board for 12 journals, law journals in that area. He holds degrees in law from Yale and Oxford, and he's been at the University of Oregon since 2002. First, let's welcome Seth Woolley.
Ladies and gentlemen of the Eugene City Club, I take it as an important honor to speak to you today about how the National Security Administration, the NSA, intercepts communications in violation of our privacy rights. I am excited, too, to hear the professor's remarks on the legal issues of this dragnet. For my introductory technical remarks, I will discuss two things. First, a broad technical picture of how the NSA is intercepting our everyday correspondences. Second, I will discuss mechanisms available today to avoid and prevent their eavesdropping on your own communications. From public reports, we now know that since 2001, around the time of the USA Patriot Act, American citizens, in addition to rightless citizens of other nations, have been under thorough and increasing electronic surveillance by the National Security Administration. We in the computer security community call what the NSA and its allied sister agencies do the gathering of signals intelligence, or data transmitted over telecommunication systems. Since going back to the Cold War, at least as far back as 1998, this project has been called Project Echelon and initially focused on intercepting the diplomatic communications among the nations of the world. Charged with monitoring foreigners only at first, it was very difficult to monitor the massive amount of traffic on the internet, and the NSA justified its wiretapping of its own citizens by focusing on what they called metadata to separate the regular communications data from data about the raw data. The NSA believes that by storing only electronic communications that describe the original data, incidentally data that are easy to seize, that they aren't actually performing a search on our data until an analyst actually looks at what was seized. Note that for non-citizens, or communications thought to be with non-citizens, there are no restrictions on their data collection. So at least for citizens, it is important to know what exactly is metadata. Today, in essentially all computer networks, data are sent around using chunks of zeros and ones called packets that are of limited size, small enough to be interleaved over a transfer medium such as a copper wire, or a portion of the electromagnetic spectrum such as a cellular radio wave, or a light wave in an optical fiber. To intercept the data, once it hits the internet backbone, the NSA uses an optical fiber splitter located at what one analyst said was at least 20 locations throughout the country, and many more places overseas with guilty cooperation of foreign governments. Specialized machines intercept the data and are equipped with specialized hardware that can understand common internet protocols in what is called a protocol stack. This stack comprises a set of nested envelopes consisting of a header, a content body, and an optional footer that facilitate communications operating at various routing layers. They go from the basic wire protocol all the way up through the routing protocols designed to reliably transmit data between computers, up to the application protocols, such as hypertext transfer protocol that forms the basis of the World Wide Web, or simple mail transfer protocol that forms the basis of our email communications. Normal routers only go up to what is called layer 3 of the protocol stack. The application layer is at the top at layer 7. The wire is down at layer 1. The machines that the NSA uses to intercept our communications can understand the entire stack all the way up to layer 7, and so we call this deep packet inspection. So again, what are metadata? Metadata are merely the envelopes of the various protocol layers, including all email and website header data. Metadata technically may include even keywords in the primary data. Essentially, the NSA is saying that since they don't keep every last byte of your data, that it's okay, that partial seizures aren't in fact seizures at all. What are they collecting? According to whistleblower revelations going back to around 2005, not just the recent Snowden disclosures, they are collecting a database of every call ever made in the United States, if not the world, going back 5 to 10 years, depending on various factors. They are also collecting metadata on every email transaction. From all this metadata, the sheer massive amount, estimated to be stored in the trillions of records on just connections, are often enough to develop a very clear picture of what is in the core data without even having to look at it, with a very high amount of accuracy. As a spatial database engineer myself, in fact, processing graph theoretic connections in a performant way is my specialty. Do not underestimate the value of mere metadata in violating privacy rights. Not only are they able to simply monitor the data, but they can also modify and replace what is intercepted to act as what is called a man in the middle, injecting their fake packets in between both endpoints. They do this when they need to target specific users who are using encrypted communications. In particular, secure web browsing such as banking websites or email hosts such as Gmail that use so-called HTTPS encrypted connections. In order to break the encryption, they mislead the connecting computer into believing they are the server computer by changing its identity on the fly and forging the identifying credentials, mathematical numbers that are supposed to be immune from forgery. How? They have become one of the major delegated certificate authorities that every browser everybody uses and trusts by default. The Electronic Frontier Foundation determined that at least 600 different entities, including the Department of Homeland Security, now have trust in the centralized encryption software of every browser. This is very similar to how a government issues passports, except private companies such as VeriSign supposedly verify the connections to a real domain name, and they delegate such verifying on an as-convenient basis. Any of the delegated verifiers can essentially give anybody passport to purport to be any website on the internet so that your web browser reports it as encrypted and actually authentic. Decades ago, the NSA was trying to get our hardware systems to be forced to use an intentionally reduced encryption system called the Clipper chip that would give them easy access to encryption. Instead of doing that, which became a flaw that was rejected by the security community as security by obscurity, a big no-no in the cryptographic community, they instead worked within the trust network that the standards bodies were creating that secured all websites and manipulated it. Today, many participants of the various engineering standards bodies have come forward and suggested that the NSA has had its hand in weakening security technology in virtually every major security or encryption-based protocol. Now that we know about this, many of those bodies now distrust the NSA and are working to correct those problems. But until they do, what can we do to prevent being spied upon both individually and collectively? First, as individuals, we should try to train ourselves to be more skeptical about our data and what it is connected to or associated with. We should thus avoid placing our private data in what is now called cloud computing, or servers hosted off-site to try to save money by allowing the data to be mined for and by corporate marketers and professional psychoanalysts trying to sell you trinkets and designer clothing. Many people don't realize that depending upon the circumstances, data in a corporate network is often not considered to have the same protections as data you hold in your own possession. So try to keep possession of your own data and not share it so often. Second, we should go into our browser settings and disable all so-called certificate authorities. Once that is done, the browser will ask you to verify the fingerprint of the website to confirm its identity next time you connect. If it's your bank, just go to them and ask them for their digital fingerprint using a side channel, such as being physically in the bank. Third, we should begin encrypting, or at least digitally signing, all of our emails with certificates that you can create yourself, using a software technique called Pretty Good Privacy, or PGP for short. This software can be used with the Mozilla Firefox version of email software called Thunderbird by installing an add-on known as Enigmail. If you're listening, just search for Enigmail in your favorite search engine for instructions. By using signed messages, even if they are not encrypted, everybody you communicate with will receive your certificate directly with every email. This allows anybody else using the same type of software to send you encrypted emails as needed, even if you don't expect to receive it in advance. These emails only will allow you to be able to decode them, presuming your computer is actually secure. To make sure your computer is actually secure, be sure to use Mozilla Firefox, not Chrome or any other corporate browser like Internet Explorer, and do the following two things. First, uninstall all certificate authorities, like mentioned. Second, install the following plugins that whitelist common privacy-violating or hackable technologies: AdBlock Plus, NoScript, and Cookie Monster. These are just the names. To get even more security before the protocols are fixed, you can use a technology and cooperative privacy network called Tor, T-O-R, short for the Onion Router. Tor machines cooperate and act as a decentralized, peer-to-peer, multiple-bounce proxy on behalf of other users who desire to send short, encrypted messages totally anonymously by obscuring the connections through a long list of anonymizing proxy connections that change at random for every new connection. The NSA would have to have access to all of the packets all over the world and reassociate them to figure out where the original packets came from. This is not technically possible at the moment. To install this, the Tor browser bundle packages a modified version of Firefox that can be installed on a dedicated privacy machine. Those are the main ways of individually staying private with your communications. Since this is a policy enlightened group, it is important to understand what we should do collectively to ensure privacy. First, we should become members of the Internet Society, the sponsors of most of the Layer 3 and above Internet protocols designed by the Internet Engineering Task Force. Layers 2 and below are generally managed by the IEEE, the Institute for Electrical and Electronics Engineers. If we're involved with the federal government, we should ensure that the NIST, or National Institute of Standards and Technology, is not being influenced by the NSA and other spooks to have a community set of standards that is functionally inferior or mathematically weak. Because there is no mathematical proof that encryption algorithm premises and related theories underpinning the hardness of our cryptography system, such as the integer factor problem, actually do their jobs, we have to depend on keeping up with flaws as they are discovered. Weakening encryption in standards bodies is extremely dangerous for privacy and even national security. If we're involved with local governments, we should ensure our own privacy laws do not involve snooping or requesting private data from computer networks just because it might exist. For more on the legal information, now is the perfect time to turn it over to my fellow presenter. And thank you for trying to stay an informed and skeptical citizen. And in regard to your upcoming questions, I plead the fifth.
Good afternoon. As Mr. Prince introduced me, my name is Q Yum from the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication. I specialize in communication law very broadly, not only in the United States, but also abroad. I am talking about the global 21st century. When we talk about freedom of expression as a human right, more than a constitutional right, under the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, we have to look at what is happening here in the United States and think about how it is affecting the whole world. By the way, for a little bit more background information, I served in the Korean Army for 33 months and 15 days in the 1970s. And not surprisingly, you know, I've enjoyed my life in the United States, not only as a naturalized U.S. citizen, but also as a First Amendment scholar. And whenever, you know, I have time, I always read and reread the U.S. Constitution. I always carry this around. I feel, you know, this is an extremely unique document. I am talking about the uniquely American document of 4,543 words. That's extraordinary. The shortest but oldest constitution of the whole world. And especially I focus upon the First Amendment. I am talking about the 45 words. Out of the 45 word First Amendment, I specialize in the freedom of the press and the freedom of speech clause. I am talking about 14 words. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. This freedom of speech and the freedom of the press clause is making the United States unique. Some people say America is an outlier, and I don't have any problem with my adopted country being an outlier on the freedom of speech and the freedom of the press. Especially when we have the kind of a crisis confronting us, not only in America and abroad, we have to think about the pathological perspective on freedom of speech and freedom of the press. I will mention that in a minute. But when we have a crisis, when we have an emergency, freedom of speech and the freedom of the press is more important than anything else. As you probably remember, virtually immediately after 9/11, Congress passed the USA Patriot Act. Virtually no dissenting voice, emotion, rather than reason, prevailed our whole society, especially Congress. That is what we have to be guarded against, simply because that's not the way our so-called rule of law should operate. Because of the time, place, and the manner of regulation imposed by the City Club, I cannot talk everything on my mind, even though I can talk about this topic forever, you know, more than 24 hours, like a U.S. senator did, you know, in the U.S. Senate. But at least, you know, I say when we talk about the First Amendment, at the same time, when it comes to privacy, we talk about privacy as a constitutional right under the 4th Amendment. Fourth Amendment is a little bit, you know, longer than the First Amendment. I am talking about the 54 word. We talk about how to protect our right to privacy against the invasion or violation by the U.S. government. Right to privacy is different to usually right of privacy. When we talk about the right of privacy, we usually talk about privacy not to be invaded by the private news media. But when we talk about the right to privacy, we talk about our right to privacy against the violation by the U.S. government. We talk about the Fourth Amendment. And that is the way we talk about the reasonable expectation of privacy. The fundamental question is what is reasonable. And privacy is kind of an evolving concept. And that is what we have to keep in mind. In the 1960s, the concept of privacy was definitely different from what we understand it to be in the 21st century. So that is what I talk about in 1967. The so-called third-party doctrine, that is very dangerous, I think, absolutely outdated concept. And when we talk about privacy, especially in the context of the National Security Act and the National Security Agency mass surveillance, simply the third-party doctrine is if you provide some information to other people, telephone companies, or Yahoo, or Google, the information is already shared with the rest of the world. Essentially, NSA says they go and they get the information, not directly from you, but from Google, from Verizon, from other telephone companies. That is what we talk about, why the third-party doctrine, which is still very much comfortable with the FISA court, a federal Intelligence Surveillance Act court. And they don't have any problem with still following the third-party doctrine, even though it was seriously questioned by the Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court last year in the case of U.S. versus Jones. So I think we have to keep in mind that is what we have to seriously question national security as a basis of just recklessly, I can say, carelessly violating the constitutional right to privacy. But when we talk about national security, the question is whether national security is really national security. More often, national security is abused and more often misused to protect the political security of government officials. And that is what we have to understand. And actually, many people say, and I do agree with them, or I assume they know what they are talking about, 99% or more of classified information in the United States is or should not be classified at all. And actually, there is sometimes some people we talk about. What we do not know here in the United States is already known to many people outside the United States. KGB knew exactly the budget for CIA operations, but Americans did not know that kind of information. And American government did not follow the rule of law. And actually, in preparation for this presentation, I just Googled something relating to the Carter administration's alleged wiretapping, interception, and eavesdropping on the Blue House in South Korea. Blue House is the South Korea's equivalent of a White House. Washington Post and the Register Guard publishing the AP story. On December 9th of 1976, the Korean government accused the U.S. government of intercepting the conversations to and from the Blue House. Of course, the South Korean government protested publicly, vociferously to the Carter administration, and Stansfield Turner, the Naval Academy classmate of President Jimmy Carter, basically said, the U.S. government does not do that. But the verbatim quotation was released, I say leaked, to the Washington Post from the U.S. government, U.S. government officials, of course. But anyway, that is not surprising. And actually, when we understand what has been going on right now, there has been close collaboration between the United States, the U.K., and of course, Australia, and Canada, and New Zealand. I am talking about, you know, more or less five countries. And they just collaborated. And right now, those countries are very seriously challenged. Why did they do that? Especially when we talk about this, Snowden Principle. Already I mentioned national security versus privacy. And countries like Brazil and England and also Germany are now wanting to do something about what the NSA has been doing for many years. But at least when we talk about the impetus, direct impetus of this kind of debate and open challenge to the U.S. government approach, I see mass surveillance has everything to do with what Edward Snowden did. At least I feel comfortable with Edward Snowden's argument. If the U.S. government is following, is violating our law without letting American citizens know what they are doing, that is against the rule of law. And that is, we have to think about this. So national security for whom? Eventual national security for Americans, but not necessarily violating the law which we have agreed to uphold. So several things I might mention, but at least a couple of things real quick. Already I mentioned classification is really a serious problem. More classification than absolutely necessary. And significantly, government officials do not know how to properly classify information. That is creating the problem. And also, when we talk about national security, especially during the time of crisis, more freedom of speech, more freedom of the press is kind of imperative rather than less. And at least, if our experience is more or less correct, no country has self-destructed because they have too much freedom. Actually, because they have no freedom, they have self-destructed. That is the lesson from our human history. So I say, eventually, what we have to think about the impact. Snowden impact, I already mentioned. European countries are asking the European Court of Human Rights to look at what England, English government has done in violation of the law. I am talking about European Convention on Human Rights. Brazil is already wanting to do something in their own way instead of routing through American internet companies. That is something interesting way to look at. And also I said Germany and other countries are wanting to update and revise the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights of 1966. It is essentially based upon the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, believe it or not. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights was kind of a brainchild of the U.S. government immediately after World War II. Mrs. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was directly involved for, you know, making the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So I said there has been going on a lot of way to challenge, but we think we can do it complacently. But at least this is my final thought. If we say our country should serve as a beacon of hope, more importantly, freedom and liberty for humankind, we should do something better for the rest of the world. And that is the message I'd like to leave with you. Thank you very, very much.
Now we'll take our traditional 5-minute break for you to compose questions as a table for our speakers, and we'll be right back after this break.
You're listening to KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, at 88.1, KLBR Bend, KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and on the web, klcc.org.
And we're back at City Club. We're listening to Seth Woolley and Kyu-ho Yeom at the October 4th meeting of the City Club of Eugene. Now it's time for your questions from our members on the topic of digital privacy.
Well, something I haven't. I'm Dan Sol at City Club since, 2005 or something. I haven't heard about it yet, but I'm thinking it's bound to pop up, or maybe it's already happened, and that's industrial sabotage. I mean, Boeing wanting to listen in on Airbus and just in general, somebody trying to hack into the system to gain a commercial leg up. Has that happened yet, or is that on its way?
There are a lot of people who believe that's one of the main roles of the U.S. government being in the Green Party, you know. Corporate sabotage is obviously something that's likely happening, but a lot of it's classified, and so I wouldn't know exactly.
There's no egregious examples yet.
Not that I'm aware of. I'm more aware of the technical aspect.
Hi, I'm Greg. I'm the student body vice president at the U of O, actually, where you teach. But our table was talking about kind of historically, you look at when the United States is involved in a war effort, the suppression of the press and free speech, things like Lincoln eliminated habeas corpus in World War I, the suppression of journalists to speak out against the war, and even most recently with Iraq and Afghanistan, coffins coming back from overseas, draped in American flags, were not allowed to be photoed by journalists and shown to the United States. So I'm wondering what sort of fight is going on right now amongst the press and the government, and what kind of key issues are defining us moving forward on those issues of freedom of speech in the press?
I am Kyu Yeom, when it comes to freedom of the press in the United States, it is very significant to mention this. I am talking about breaking news, kind of. The Committee to Protect Freedom of the Press is now investigating freedom of the press in the United States. It is something unprecedented. I say, generally speaking, when Committee to Protect the Freedom of the Press is investigating, usually the committee is focusing upon authoritarian countries, in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. But now they are wanting to know what is going on, and simply because they feel American journalists are more subject to all kind of restraints. And at this point, I think freedom of the press, some people say, is a lot more widely restrained by the Obama administration. And some people like James Goodale, he was, vice president for the New York Times, counsel for the New York Times during the Pentagon Papers, basically said Obama is worst president when it comes to freedom of the press, worse than, Mr. I say George Bush. But I think right now, significantly, because of the Obama administration's aggressive prosecution of freedom of the press-related issues, the Senate Judiciary Committee, 1 or 2 weeks ago, passed the Free Flow of Information Act. That is a kind of federal type of media shield law, and it is open question, but many people say it is not enough, but at least for me it is definitely better than nothing. So there is something positive going on, but at the same time the executive branch under President Obama does not hesitate to use all kind of possible ingenious way to tame the often recalcitrant American press.
And quickly, one ironic point I would like to make about freedom of the press, in particular regarding other countries. I'm Seth Woolley, by the way. I'm supposed to ID myself. regarding freedom of the press in other countries, in fact, the Tor Network program that I talked about was actually written and funded by the United States government for political dissidents in foreign nations to enable their freedom of speech. So it's kind of a little ironic that we have to discuss our own freedom of speech at the same time we're actually making technologies that, at the same time, the NSA is trying to crack.
I'm Jerry Diethelm, City Club member. We're wondering how each of you relate to what Senator Wyden has been doing in the Congress, how each of the messages that you've brought today, how you would respond to what he's doing or not doing. And there's a second question at the table, too. One person, after you have a chance to think about that, wanted to know, because they couldn't quite follow all of the things that they might do to protect their privacy, if there was a simple, kind of a shorter answer to how they might protect themselves.
So the plan is that the text of the speech plus a 20-slide PowerPoint will be posted to the website later that you can review at a slower pace. Maybe that helps. And the first question regarding what Wyden's doing, I think Wyden's inherently limited in what he can do because of the nature that that there's classified information that he and his staff obviously would fear revealing. So I think it's good that what they can do at the federal level, our Congress critters are doing. But at the same time, we need to have the people expressing, repeating what's happening, that these whistleblowers reveal that our own state won't be able to keep repeating. So I think it depends more on us.
Again, Q. Young. Senator Wyden has been one of the few lawmakers who have been challenging the U.S. government to be more transparent and to be more open about what they have been doing, especially NSA. And some of his suggestive questioning has been very useful. And the fact that Senator Wyden has been pushing the envelope on more transparency and openness is really important. Otherwise, just because that kind of question has not been done as part of the lawmaking or deliberative process, few Americans are aware of it. And even I say Senator Wyden is still saying NSA has not been as forthright as they should be. That is very important. So I wish we had more Wydens now than ever. That is really important. And when it comes to privacy, at least from a legal perspective, I think, like you, we need more engaged people. And we have more people and organizations who have been more or less very dismayed and depressed once they knew that, NSA has not been following, the rule of law. Instead of playing by the book, they try to just expand the sometimes questionable interpretations of the Supreme Court interpretations. And also now senators, including Senator Leahy, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, basically says he learns more about NSA from American news media than from NSA. That is more or less revealing. So sometimes that is why some people say Edward Snowden has done something which has been very important, at least forcing us to outgrow our otherwise complacent approach, giving too much trust in the government, especially in this kind of crisis.
Jerry Smith, City Club member. First, a comment.
I left the Army in Washington, D.C. in 1958. In 1960, I went to work in the Overseas News Department of the Christian Science Monitor. It took 2 years for us to prove that there were any Americans fighting in Vietnam when in fact, Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines were running the whole thing, flying the planes. It was worse then than it is now. It's bad now. It was much worse then. Journalists knew that the war was on, and they couldn't find a single way to get an attributable article in. Now, my question now is, television is absolutely swarmed with CSIs, Criminal Investigation Services, and if one quarter of what they're saying or portraying is right, we're in a big mess. If you have a credit card, they know where you are and what you're doing. Instantly, they know what's in your bank. If you have a cell phone, even an illegal cell phone, they know where you are at the very moment that it's in your pocket. And you watch the programs unfold as they track people using those methods. Are those methods real?
I suppose I can answer that. So my background, this is Seth Woolley again. My background is as a spatial database engineer for a navigation company that writes cell phone software that does driving directions, that uses GPS chips. And we get, for example, traffic data by what's called cell phone probes. The cellular companies are keeping track of the sector and distance from the cell tower of essentially everybody, and then with a slight bit of anonymizing, then just sending it directly to whatever private interest is willing to pay for it, and that includes governments. There are many cases where there's a little bit of anonymizing going on. We all that technology in CSI essentially is true, although it's pretty expensive to actually deploy. So that's one consideration. I don't think it happens as much as CSI portrays it, but it's definitely possible. And GPS tracking is a serious concern because it's the cell phones have a way to call back to be called back by the cell towers to install software remotely on it. So that's one thing that they can do. They can, even though the phones right now don't send their data back, the actual GPS points back, they can be made to send as much data as they want, including audio or video. They can turn on the camera and send that data back just by uploading a single, very tiny piece of software in the background based on your SIM card. And it's pretty straightforward, and we know from published reports that it is done, so it is possible.
This is Q Yum, and when it comes to legal issues, especially technology is just moving so fast, and as you probably know, law is more or less evolutionary, not revolutionary. So law is more or less reactive, I say passive. But the question is whether American judges, I say Supreme Court, are willing to face that kind of a reality or be more creatively and ingeniously. And sometimes they say, I say, if organizations or individuals challenge what NSA has been doing, sometimes American judges say, prove what kind of direct harm you have suffered. But the dilemma is, how can you know? If you don't know what they don't know, and that is the creating problems. So you don't have any information from NSA, even though you feel and you assume, based upon your own experience, that they are doing something. And that is what we have now learned since what Snowden has done. I am talking about the revealed. And now, at least, sooner rather than later, the U.S. Supreme Court will revisit what they have thought over the years. And the so-called content versus record distinction is less than convincing. Content means you should go and find what you have told to your friend over the phone. And the record means you just dialed. But sometimes whom you are dialing, when and where, is a lot more revelatory than the content. So that is what we have to pay attention to at the moment.
Dina Will, City Club member. The question of Edward Snowden and what might be happening to him if he hadn't planned how he would disappear at the same time he planned what he was going to dump into our consciousness about the surveillance. He would be in jail, and he might be treated as Bradley Manning was, which included being locked up for 9 months, I believe, naked in a cell. Is Snowden a hero or a villain is the question that no longer appears in the newspapers. What's appearing in the media I read are analyses of what Snowden has done, of what it has done for our country, of people saying, now that we know this, it's really important to discuss various questions. They wouldn't know it if Snowden hadn't dumped that data. My question is, can the U.S. government, do you think, be trusted to give justice to anyone like Edward Snowden, given what he did? They certainly didn't, you know, when they stopped that plane carrying the Brazilian president, they were showing they were really mad. Should Snowden have gone underground?
Again, Q. Young. At the moment, Snowden is somewhere in Russia. And, you know, I say, you know, it is always, you know, a debatable issue whether he should be treated as a villain versus as a hero, depending on what kind of priorities you have when it comes to what the United States stands for. You know, very important issue. And at least even the NSA director acknowledges the valuable contribution, you know, by Snowden. I am talking about Snowden's impact on opening or starting the conversation, the dialogue, and of course, the transparency. And I think, you know, that is quite important. And but also at the same time, we have to think about this. You know, when we say information is very valuable. But the fundamental questions are whether the information is accessible only to a limited segment of Americans, as compared to a broad segment of people, not only in the United States, but also abroad. And the information revealed by him did not only directly Americans, but also other people. So that is why he's, you know, we talk about the human right. Privacy is a human right, rather than as a constitutional right of the United States. So broader issues is quite important. And at least when we talk about Snowden, American media, I say American, you know, media people are still very uncomfortable with what he did. And that is what Senator Feinstein basically say, someone like him and, you know, WikiLeaks, Julian Assange should not be treated as a journalist. At least that is what the Senate Judiciary Committee basically said when they adopted, when they passed the Free Flow of Information, you know, Act. So I say at least, you know, it depends upon how you look at the whole picture. But generally speaking, the impact of Snowden is definitely a lot more positive rather than just what a dismissive thing.
So real quick. The question, one of the questions was, can he get? Would there be justice if he didn't go underground? And I think you just have to look at Bradley Manning to see what would happen. So I think that answers that question. As far as the past, we may remember the Pentagon Papers, where there was no, you know, retribution, you know, retributive reaction to that. And I think part of the reason for that is that you may have heard of the term of Obama's war on whistleblowers. He's been prosecuting whistleblowers at a dramatically increased rate, and even much more than Bush was, or Bush the Second, or whatever you want to call it. And I think that's demonstrative of the different situation we're now in.
Maybe not. Can I just add just one thing? You know, even though I might have portrayed a little bit more, you know, how can I say, you know, sort of negative, you know, picture of what we have been doing, but at least when it comes to the First Amendment, our record is still very impressive. You know, when we talk about the, you know, prior restraint on freedom of expression,
I think still prior restraint is almost unthinkable in the United States. I am talking of prior restraint on freedom of speech and freedom of the press. And so, at least, you know, that is why I wanted to mention this. You know, friend of the court on the front line of the First Amendment, authored by the preeminent First Amendment constitutional lawyer Floyd Abrams. It came out 4 months ago, and I think, you know, he is making a good point. By the way, I am using this book for my communication law class at the moment. And he said this. I said, when the government is arguing national security as a basis for restraining or regulating freedom of speech and the freedom of the press, Americans should be a lot more skeptical, a lot more critical, and sometimes a lot more, you know, approaching that kind of issue with, you know, more or less dubiously. Because, you know, the First Amendment is preventing the government from violating the constitutional, you know, right to free speech and nothing else. So that is why the government has an extraordinary burden of justifying why they are doing this or that. And that is why we ask, we demand, actually, more transparency, less classification. We spend more time for keeping information away from American citizens rather than sharing the information with Americans, even though we have Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, which was passed by Congress in the mid-1960s. And we are not following what Congress asked the government to do. Less information rather than more. That is something we have to keep in mind.
John DeWinter, City Club. Given that the U.S. government classifies more information than it should as secret or top secret, what would be the essential elements of a program that you would recommend to replace the current system?
Technologically.
So technically, what I would say is that there's this principle in cryptography about security by obscurity that I mentioned. It's called Kirchhoff's principle. Essentially that a system isn't secure unless if the information has to be secret in order to maintain its security, because you must assume that the enemy knows the secrets. So I think we need to, like, maybe encode that somehow into our laws to say that if we have a security apparatus, we need to actively work towards minimizing it, because that's how you increase security, and that's how cryptographers think, who actually spend their lives dealing directly with these issues.
You know, I say when it comes to classification process, no civilian, more or less independent-minded person is involved. So it means classifying government officials are just doing more over-classification rather than under-classification, simply because that is human nature. Usually people who are responsible for classifying documents are more or less expendable, low-ranking government officials. And they are wanting to make sure they will lose their job by over-classifying rather than under-classifying. But when we talk about, you know, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, it is not, you know, adversarial. The government is arguing this or that. Nobody can rebut or refute that kind of allegation. So in this kind of context, I'd like to see some kind of independent civilian to get involved in the classification process instead of just the government officials talking to each other in the more or less a dark basement, you know, of their office. And they are just stamping over and over and over, nothing else. Once something is stamped, classified, it takes so many years, so much time, so much money to declassify it. It is not for us. It is only for those government officials who happened to be assigned to, you know, stamp classified. So that's no good for us.
Hi, James Baldock, City Club member since 2012. Now that the NSA surveillance programs have been declassified and everybody knows about them, you know, you mentioned a free web browser and three other free programs that you're like, hey, NSA can't track you anymore. Presumably, terrorists who are slightly tech savvy can install the free stuff, and now they can't be surveyed. I'm just wondering what value, if any, to national security do these programs provide?
what value to national security? Do they impact it negatively? Is that what you're asking?
No, like, so presumably before you were catching emails, people weren't bothering securing them. But now that there's an easy way that's free to secure your emails, I'm just curious if you know what the benefit for us as far as, you know, catching plots. How can you catch plots now?
Oh, well, the main way they catch plots is they go to the end points between on the opposite sides of the encryption, and they take them into a room and talk to them. Or they break into their computer. The endpoint security is where the NSA has actually been focusing most of its efforts, because cryptography nowadays is actually pretty hard to break. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, that was a different story. But nowadays, the math has gotten a lot better. But I just have to say, the cryptography is available. They're going to get it. It's out of the bag, so we have to be able to work around it.
Well, I guess if you have a short comment, I'll ask a quick question. Mine is about the role of fear in American politics. I think a lot of us in the legal profession think some of the darkest days of our civil liberties were after World War II and the trauma of Pearl Harbor, when on the West Coast Japanese Americans were interned. And it took us, you know, 5 years or 4 years to think better of that and come around. The trauma of 9/11 obviously was great in a similar way. But when DARPA wanted to start a program called Total Information Awareness in 2002, they were stymied. In 2003, when it was revealed that the leader of the program was disgraced former Admiral Poindexter of Iran-Contra fame. So even in 2002 and 2003, we were not afraid enough to do that. Yet what we've discovered recently is that the core elements of that program continued and became part of the NSA program. And in fact, the Patriot Act did not originally authorize the kind of group metadata collection, the business records collection, this mass collection of things. The 2008 amendments to it did. So I guess my concern personally is that I see there are dark periods in our history when we make bad decisions as a society because we are fearful. And my concern now is, after this trauma, we were understandably fearful, but our fear seems to be getting greater rather than less, and allowing more intrusion into our liberties rather than less. Do you have any way out of that bag or suggestions?
Stop watching so much TV, maybe. I know. I would think that, you know, it's kind of a popular culture thing. Like back in the what was it, 80s or something, Frank Herbert's Dune came out, where fear was the mind killer. But nowadays, I don't know if we talk about how bad fear is. Instead, we watch. Also, the internet's kind of a problem too, in that people are able to get in these echo chambers where they develop and manifest and amplify their own fears by hardening their own political philosophy. The enemy is much worse than you know they really are. And this comes down to also partisanship, Republicans, Democrats. This visceral hatred, gridlock in Washington. And so I think we need to, as a culture, start examining how we can be more rational about our fears.
Yeah, you know, Q. Young again. The 9/11 impact is absolutely pervasive. You know, I think probably it will be forever with us, you know, no question about it, especially direct attack, you know, upon our people by foreigners. And I think, you know, the question is how, you know, the fear, you know, which sometimes we perceive rather than we really, you know, feel it is more often, you know, magnified. You know, that is why I say sort of emotion, especially when you talk about government officials. Government officials are often tempted to play on fear rather than just looking at the questions, you know, directly. And that is why whenever there is some possible room for sort of expansive interpretation of some kind of law, they use it, even though that kind of interpretation was or should be incompatible with the intent of lawmakers. And that is where judges should look at very carefully. But when it comes to foreign intelligence surveillance court's approach is they just usually 99% say just yes, simply because there is no adversarial ground. Even though the arguments of the government, I am talking about NSA officials, can be directly challenged or repudiated by just using some of the court cases, but foreign intelligence surveillance court judges are fundamentally uncomfortable with the kind of challenge. More or less, I think the majority, absolute majority of the 11, foreign surveillance, intelligence surveillance court judges are or have been appointed by Chief Justice John Roberts of the U.S. Supreme Court. That kind of political leanings cannot be ignored blithely.
Well, thank you for bringing clarity and vision to the City Club discussion of digital privacy and the NSA. Thank you to our speakers.
Thank you.
And a special thank you to them for filling on relatively short notice. Senator Wyden's wanted very much to be here to speak on this topic, but recent events in D.C. thwarted that intent. We will schedule a program with him as soon as he's available. Well, as soon as he's available, if and when he's available. The senatorial schedule permits it. I know he would like to be here, and he will speak on a similar topic, but I think he'll have a little different perspective on it. Next week, we'll meet on October 11th in Eugene Hilton, the Sousa Room for When and Where is Sleep a Legal Right with activist Ali Valkyrie and County Commissioner Pat Farr. And the week after, we'll be back here at LCC for an evening program for Making Great American Cities. So that'll be a special program, and keep an eye out. Thank you very much.